Thank you so much, Ralph. I'm really glad that you brought us this book. It's one I hadn't known before, and I hope that maybe we can leave it sitting up here for people to take a look at since the images weren't ideal as we share our potluck meal. A few reasons I'm really glad to have been introduced to this book. It's really good to be reminded that there are things to be grateful for every day, right? That there are blessings to be found in the cycle of seasons and in the presence of community. This is how I think about the Thanksgiving holiday, as time to take a breath and remember gratitude. It's also good to be reminded of how important ceremony is, how ritualized gratitude holds communities together. The book mentions the Cherokee New Moon ceremony, which is a time of thanksgiving to the Creator and the ancestors, which happens in the fall because that's when Cherokee stories say the world was created. And the green corn ceremony, a celebration of the new corn crop that happens in July or August. And finally, it's good to be reminded that history should be celebrated and remembered, even when it's hard. The book mentions the Cherokee New Year, which commemorates the original signing of the 1839 Cherokee Constitution and has been celebrated since 1953. And it mentions the Trail of Tears, the forced removal of the members of the Cherokee, Muscogee or Creek, Seminole, Chickasaw, and Choctaw nations from their ancestral homelands between 1830 and 1850. Around 100,000 Cherokee people were forced to walk over 950 miles, dealing with exposure, disease, and starvation, and thousands of them died along the way. Cherokee people now do an annual bike ride called Remember the Removal, where they ride the northern part of the Trail of Tears, the part the Cherokee were walked on, stopping at numerous historic sites and markers to honor the ancestors and the steps that they have taken. This book was written as a Cherokee language book, written at least in part to keep the Cherokee language alive. One of the ways we know that colonization has diminished our native siblings was by taking their language from them, and this is a struggle across the country. For Native peoples to relearn their languages and pass them down. This was done in several ways that were both overt and covert. One of the very overt ways was taking children away from their parents and putting them into boarding schools to remove them from their culture and assimilate them into the culture of the colonizers. Did you know that the Unitarians ran one of these schools? It was called Bond's Mission, named after Henry and Pamela Bond, who ran it. It was run on Crow land in what is now called Montana from 1886 until 1895. So I want to lift up something that was on the very first page, the reminder to celebrate our blessings and reflect on struggles. The Reverend Kerry Parker, director of the Wisconsin Council of Churches, came here last month to talk with us about the work of reparations at our request. And one of the things that she said that will stick with me for a long time is that November is a month of mourning for our Native siblings. As the descendants of the colonizers made up and passed on stories about the generosity of the Native people that form the basis for the U.S. Thanksgiving holiday we celebrate today, the people themselves were and are grieving the loss of their homelands, their relatives, and their ways of life. I am grateful and humbled to know that a book like this is possible to write in the midst of that grief, a book that offers gratitude and celebration in this season for the harvest, for the naming of the children, for the presence of community, and that brings remembering and honoring of the ancestors who lived the brutality of history. We hold these things in the same bowl, grief and gratitude, right? And it is a generous gift to learn a little bit about how that can be done. I think this book helps us with that. To be aware that this is a gift, this ability to hold grief and gratitude in the same bowl, I have needed to unlearn some things. The first of these is that grief and gratitude aren't opposite ends of a spectrum, but rather two responses to the beauty and the brutality of the world that can be felt at the exact same time. The psychotherapist Frances Weller said, "The work of the mature person is to carry grief in one hand and gratitude in the other, and to be stretched large by them." I can let the full impact of Bond's mission and the Trail of Tears sink in. I can feel the immensity of anger and sadness at the arrogance of our settler forebears. And I can be grateful for the survival of the bodies and spirits of the people who lived here first at the same time. I can mourn the loss of elders and celebrate the birth of babies. I can let the grief for our earth home sink in while still marveling at the call of sandhill cranes flying overhead. A second thing I've had to unlearn is the lie of the supremacist mindset. The layers of oppression symbolized here were born of this colonization and commodification mindset, this idea that humans can claim land as their own, regardless of who's living on it. The idea that some humans have more of a right to what we call resources than other humans and other beings. The idea that some humans can control the thoughts and bodies of other humans and other beings. We can trace this mindset back to at least 1452 with the papal bulls that articulated the doctrine of discovery, the authorization of colonial powers such as Spain and Portugal to seize lands and subjugate people in Africa and in the New World, as long as people on the lands weren't Christians. In case you don't know this, a papal bull is a decree by the Pope. So the authorization to claim the land in this and other countries was a religious one. I want to go back further than this and learn something about why this was even possible, even at that date. Where did it come from? This arrogance that led people to think this was okay. I want to dig into that. I didn't have time to dig into that in time for today, but I'm going to dig into that. In any case, this religious decree became the basis for a legal concept here in the US when the doctrine of discovery was invoked in an 1823 US Supreme Court ruling that indigenous people only had rights of occupancy, not ownership, over lands they had long lived on. That means something very different to a native person than it does to a colonizer. This paved the way for all of this, all of it. And even though the doctrine has finally been repudiated by the Vatican, did you know that? March of this year, the Vatican, Pope Francis said, this is not what we do this year. Even though that doctrine has finally been repudiated, the supremacist mindset lives on. This is our water. This is our soil. A third thing I have had to unlearn is a consumerist or an extraction mindset. This is the idea that we need stuff to be happy, that we're entitled to that stuff regardless of who or what it damages for us to get it, and that there's not enough stuff to go around, even though we need more. That is a whole reflection in and of itself, which I have offered on some Thanksgiving weekends and will likely do again. What I want to offer you is another way. Dr. Robin Wall Kimmerer, botanist and plant ecologist and member of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation in what is now called New York, wrote an essay this time last year called The Serviceberry, An Economy of Abundance. Here's how she begins. The cool breath of evening slips off the wooded hills, displacing the heat of the day. And with it come the birds, as eager for the cool as I am. They arrive in a flock of calls that sound like laughter, and I have to laugh back with the same delight. They are all around me, cedar waxwings and catbirds and a flash of bluebird iridescence. I have never felt such a kinship to my namesake, Robin, as in this moment when we are both stuffing our mouths with berries and chortling with happiness. The bushes are laden with fat clusters of red, blue, and wine purple in every stage of ripeness, so many you can pick them by the handful. I'm glad I have a pail and wonder if the birds will be able to fly with their bellies as full as mine. This abundance of berries feels like a pure gift from the land. I have not earned, paid for, nor labored for them. There is no mathematics of worthiness that reckons I deserve them in any way. And yet here they are, along with the sun and the air and the birds and the rain, gathering in the towers of cumulonimbi. You could call them natural resources or ecosystem services, but the robins and I know them as gifts. We both sing gratitude with our mouths full. This is what Dr. Kimmerer calls a gift economy. If we can learn to see things more as gifts than as commodities or things we're entitled to, we're more likely to be grateful for them. And it invokes this gift economy, a connection between gratitude and generosity. Generosity like the gifts of the season, freely given, not so much like the narrative of this holiday. She continues, in the presence of such gifts, gratitude is the intuitive first response. The gratitude flows toward our plant elders and radiates to the rain, to the sunshine, to the improbability of bushes spangled with morsels of sweetness in a world that can be bitter. Gratitude is so much more than a polite thank you. It is the thread that connects us in a deep relationship, simultaneously physical and spiritual, as our bodies are fed and spirits nourished by the sense of belonging, which is the most vital of foods. Gratitude creates a sense of abundance, the knowing that you have what you need. In that climate of sufficiency, our hunger for more abates, and we take only what we need in respect for the generosity of the giver. If our first response is gratitude, she continues, then our second is reciprocity, to give a gift in return. What could I give these gifts in return for their generosity? It could be a direct response, like weeding or water, or a song of thanks that sends appreciation out on the wind, or indirect, like donating to my local land trust so that more habitat for the gift givers will be saved, or making art that invites others into the web of reciprocity. Gratitude and reciprocity are the currency of a gift economy, and they have the remarkable property of multiplying with every exchange, their energy concentrating as they pass from hand to hand, a truly renewable resource. I accept the gift from the bush, and then spread that gift with a dish of berries to my neighbor, who makes a pie to share with his friend, who feels so wealthy in food and friendship that he volunteers at the food pantry. You know how it goes. To name the world as gift is to feel one's membership in the web of reciprocity. It makes you happy and it makes you accountable. That is the thought I want to leave you with. That in the midst of this, in the midst of supremacy and colonization, there is the idea, the thought, the knowing that we might feel our own membership in the web. that we might find gratitude for the generosity of the other members of the web, be they human or more than human, and in turn find our own generosity expanding to them. That we might unlearn the mindset that has done such damage to not just our native siblings and our earth home, but to ourselves in our disconnection, in our consumerism, in our superiority. This meal that we will share together after the service, made up of the generosity of two communities of Unitarian Universalists, is a step on that path of unlearning. May it be so, and may we be so.